The myth of the vampire is widespread in many cultures, especially those of Eastern Europe. The concept of vampirism, which is the belief in these blood-sucking evil spirits and their malevolent deeds, has a long and nuanced medical history as well. I'm joined by consultant psychiatrist Dr. Brendan Kelly, who studied this area as well as the origins of the vampire myth. Now, Brendan, obviously, the most famous fictional vampire is our very own Count Dracula. I say our very own because he was invented by Bram Stoker. There was a medical influence, but there was a huge medical influence in the Stoker family, wasn't there?
Stoker came from a strong medical family. Three of his brothers qualified as surgeons. And this influence is very clear in Dracula, which is a fantastic read by any standards. And the account of the blood transfusion that's given to Lucy in it is, for example, very similar to the account provided in the Dublin Journal of Medical Science in 1870. Dr. Robert McDonnell had done the first blood transfusion in Ireland, in Dublin, around 5 years earlier. And his description, his vivid description of that in the journal, is very much echoed in Stoker's novel. So there's a strong medical influence.
Is there a psychiatric dimension as well?
Oh, there certainly is. In the novel Dracula, there is a psychiatrist, a 29-year-old psychiatrist who has an entire asylum under his control. And in it, there's a patient, Renfield, who has what's called zoophagia and appears to be, to a greater or lesser degree, a vampire.
Mm. Where does the classic vampire myth come from?
Stoker was repackaging the stories from Transylvania and from Eastern Europe, but the vampire myth seems to have bubbled to the surface of pretty much most cultures in one way or another. So in response to your question, where does it come from? It seems to come from deep within the human psyche.
I mean, there are biblical references to it to some extent.
Sure,
there
are references in Leviticus. There are references in almost all religious traditions, in almost all literatures throughout the world from all continents. And there's a remarkable similarity in the way that they come forth.
Mm. Now, purported outbreaks of vampires have been taken very, very seriously by authorities throughout history. Tell us about a case in Serbia in 1755.
Well, the Austrian Empress Marie Theresa had to send her personal physician to certain Serbian territories because there was widespread panic about vampires. Two people had allegedly returned from the dead. Now, what's interesting is her physician concluded there was no evidence of vampiric activity whatsoever, but this didn't quell the hysteria and the panic. And it's one of the features of the vampire myth is that whenever it appears, it grabs hold of people's imagination and it gets spread and developed. So, for example, early vampire myths were very, very dark and somewhat bestial. Whereas nowadays, with the Americanization of the vampire and the prettification, if you like, of the vampires, sympathies appear to have shifted. Nowadays, we're supposed to feel sympathy for vampires because it's difficult for them to get blood. They live forever while other people die. And now we're supposed to empathize with them as opposed to fear them.
And what are the factors that do you think actually fueled the belief in vampirism, the creation of this myth?
Well, often there are incidents that trigger a vampire panic. So, for example, someone who is dead, their body may be dug up and it may appear less decomposed than one might have expected. And then this leads to general hysteria. Or a person who has travelled far away is imagined to be dead, suddenly reappears. And this triggers hysteria, which then takes on a life of its own and gets reflected in literature, in plays and in all kinds of media. So any incident can be seized upon and developed by a crowd.
Now, in 1999, in the same publication that you mentioned having inspired Stoker, the Irish Journal of Psychological Medicine, there was a case report published. You were involved in the publication of it. You co-wrote it. And it was on the subject of vampirism. Tell us about that.
Well, this was the case of a gentleman who presented to a hospital saying that he believed he was a vampire and he was in search of the hospital's supply of stored blood as he did not want to hurt anybody by biting them. So he was clearly in a state of some distress, in a state of some confusion. And the staff at the hospital said, OK, you know, we think we can help you, but rather than getting you blood, we're going to get you a psychiatrist to come and talk to you. And this person turned out to be quite clearly deluded or mentally ill. But there's a very important distinction to be drawn between people who have a delusion, that is to say, believe they are a vampire, and people who behave in a vampiric way. There are now vast networks of people who engage in vampiric acts. There are vampiric websites, all kinds of vampiric paraphernalia available on the internet. And these people are what might be called lifestylers rather than people with delusions.
And while researching this particular paper, you looked at some of the medical literature on vampirism. What did you find? find there?
Well, there are two main strands to the literature. Vampirism has been linked with certain medical illnesses like tuberculosis or pellagra. And these are kinds of disorders where people might appear pale, might be malnourished and might have benefited at one point or other from blood transfusions. The other side to the literature was the psychiatric or psychoanalytic side, which is where analysts, in a very Freudian or Jungian way, analysed vampiric beliefs and behaviours and came to all kinds of startling conclusions about what it might represent.
Did you come across specific case studies about individuals relating to vampirism?
Yes, there was a series of cases presented in the world's leading journals like Archives of General Psychiatry, and many of them were of auto-vampirism. So, for example, there was one gentleman who could cut an artery in his arm and manipulate it such that he could drink a jet of his own blood, and that was known as auto-vampirism. And there were other people who traded blood for various other kinds of favours, shall we say, in the prison system. So sometimes the vampiric behaviour served an apparent psychological purpose and sometimes a more mundane economic purpose in a closed system like a prison.
And is vampirism a genuine clinical condition, or is it still just a very powerful myth?
It's a very powerful myth. And certainly the way that psychiatry is practiced today, we would say that a person who believes they are a vampire has a bizarre delusion. That is to say, they believe something that's very unusual. It could equally be something else. So, for example, the man I saw who believed he was a vampire was from Eastern Europe. Perhaps had he been from a country where the vampire myth is less prevalent, he might have believed something quite different.
And since that, since writing that article, which was back in 1999, you've delved deeper into the history, the medical history of vampirism. What kind of things have you discovered?
Well, Dr. Seamus McSovna and myself delved into the psychiatric history because we were interested that in the 1950s, people who said they were vampires tended to be psychoanalysed, and conclusions were drawn regarding the fulfilment of oral needs, the need to control other humans, and the need then to merge with another being, because when the vampire feeds upon someone, that person too becomes a vampire. So these are very rich, detailed interpretations from the 1950s and 1960s. Whereas today, with our modern diagnostic systems, we would just say this was a bizarre delusion. So what we're interested in was what we called the loss of meaning in psychiatry, where the modern classification systems don't really delve into the meaning of the symptom for the individual. For example, it's an interesting question. Why does someone believe that they have become a vampire as opposed to believing something else, like that aliens or the internet is controlling their brain?
Now, the paper that you wrote in August of 2011, which was called Vampirism as Mental Illness, Myth, Madness and the Loss of Meaning in Psychiatry, what was the reaction to it?
Well, the newspapers covered the story quite a lot, and it tended to be covered in quite a dramatic, melodramatic fashion. Our paper was really an appeal for thoughtfulness when people engage in vampiric behaviour and realising that this can be a lifestyle choice, albeit sometimes linked with mental illness. So the newspapers covered it as if I was saying everyone who had vampiric behaviour was ill, whereas that was not the case. And then the vampire websites took up on the matter and claimed I was stating that everyone who was interested in vampirism was mentally ill. And nothing could be further from the truth.
So you were persona non grata amongst vampire websites.
I believe I am still unloved in the vampire community. And they still write about these papers and they still write about my views. And there seems to be a need to be rejected. They seem unable to accept acceptance.
Okay, I would be concerned if I was the object of the obloquy of vampire websites. Why is, finally, the myth so enduring? Is it just because it's a handy template for making scary movies?
It's a handy template for movies, for books, for all kinds of things. It's a very broad myth. You can project a lot of different meanings onto it. But most of all, the literature suggests that vampire movies and novels are so popular because they allow us to have vicarious satisfaction of certain psychological needs. In other words, by watching vampires biting people and drinking blood, we don't need to do so ourselves.
Brendan Kelly, unbeloved of vampire websites, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. In fact, that's all we've got time for in this week's programme. You'll find details of all our items on our website. While you're there, you can podcast the programme. Next week, our lineup will include food we ate during the emergency and, staying with the theme of eating, the tragic fate of a lad from Limerick who was killed and cannibalised by his shipmates in the 1800s. Many thanks to this evening's readers, Maeve Mooney, Marion Richardson, Kevin Reynolds and Dermot Byrne. Until then, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Yeti Redmond, goodbye and enjoy the rest of your weekend.